you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is data for state and local freight planning. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing your audio over the computer as well. We are offering voice over IP, and that actually is the default that the audio will come over your speakers on your computer. And then if you're having any problems hearing over your computer, you're welcome to call into the phone line and listen in. Today we'll have three presenters, DK Ahanatu of Cambridge Systematics, Michael Anderson of the University of Alabama Huntsville, and Joel Falter of KOA Corporation. DK Ahanatu is a senior associate in the Atlanta office of Cambridge Systematics with 15 years of consulting and research experience in freight transportation planning and management. He has worked on freight data collection projects for DOTs in Oregon, Colorado, California, Texas, and Tennessee. He has also managed several national-level research projects relating to freight data, including his current management of NCFRP 20, developing subnational commodity flow databases. Michael Anderson is an associate professor of civil engineering at the University of Alabama Huntsville. His specialties include transportation and traffic engineering, traffic modeling and travel demand forecasting, freight transportation, and urban planning. He has worked extensively with the Alabama Department of Transportation and the Alabama MPOs on projects related to travel demand modeling and freight. Joe Falter is the Chief Operating Officer and a Principal Transportation Planner for KOA Corporation. He has almost 30 years of experience in the field of transportation and has prepared a wide variety of transportation planning and traffic engineering studies for local, regional, and state agencies. Some of his goods movement projects have included OD studies for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, Caltrans, SCAG, Sandbag, Kerncog, including the US 395, SR 58, I-5, and SR 99 freeway corridors. He is currently conducting an OD study for Kerncog on five state routes in Kern County. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated to the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask the question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on your screen. Finally, I'd like to remind you that this session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend this seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next week, and I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript of the seminar. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name. Or if you're attending with a group of people, please type your first and last name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits for after the seminar. Please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. Even if you're not applying for AICP credits, I do encourage you to fill out the evaluation form and send it to me, as we do want to make these seminars work well for you. So now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is data for state and local freight planning. And our first presenter will be DK Ahanatu of Cambridge Systematics. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. So DK, I'm going to bring up your presentation and you can go ahead when you're ready.
Okay, thank you. The title of my presentation is Using National Freight Data for Local Planning. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I'll be covering, I'm going to spend some time talking about the three major national freight data sources, the Commodity Flow Survey put out by the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, the Federal Highway Administration Freight Analysis Framework, or FAST database, and Train Search as well. how to think about using these data for local freight planning efforts, talking about the strengths and limitations of these databases and the different aspects that you should consider when applying these for local freight planning projects. And then also going to spend some time talking about NCFRP 20. As Jennifer mentioned, this is the research project on developing a sub-national commodity flow data. This project has completed the first two tasks and moving on to the third task. We're going to talk about some of the preliminary findings and what the next steps will be for that study. And then conclude by talking about a few local freight data collection efforts that occurred in Washington for two different commodities and just compare and contrast the outcomes of these local freight data collection efforts. So first, in terms of the CFS, the Commodity Flow Survey, I think it's pretty important to make sure you have a detailed understanding of this database if you're going to be using some of these national freight data sources. First, CFS is the primary source data for the freight analysis framework, that's the second version of it, FAF 2. And it's also one of the major data sources for estimating short distance truck trips in the TransSearch database. So CFS is the data in CFS are used for the other national freight data sources as well. In terms of what is the Commodity Flow Survey, it's a shipper survey, so it surveys companies that are in the surveys companies of different establishments that actually ship goods across the country. It's basically an address-based survey, so they survey companies based on their addresses and based on the types of industries that they're in as well, and it's only a certain select amount of industries that are included in the database. But they did get over 100,000 responses. The database does cover, in terms of the regional coverage, there's 117 regions that the country is divided into, and this is across seven modes, and they collect information on 23 commodities as well. So it's a very unique and useful database that can be used for many different freight planning efforts, including, you know, doing trade flow analyses, understanding how different regions are related to others in terms of economic output and economic production and inputs and outputs. So it does have a lot of different very good uses in terms of doing freight planning at the local level. But I'm going to talk about some of the things to keep in mind as you use this data. And in particular, I want to focus on some of the aspects of this database that may make it conflict with some other local freight data sources that people may be aware of. The first thing I mentioned is that it is a survey of select sectors. The main ones that are included are mining, manufacturing, wholesale trade, retail trade, and what they call auxiliary establishments. So it's not just headquarters that are included. All of a company's establishments are potential candidates for this survey. In terms of what's not included, there are several sectors that are not included, and I highlighted the one in yellow. Highlighted the ones in yellow here that are probably most problematic in terms of doing local freight planning. First, on the agricultural side, farms are not included, so the source of many of these agricultural products will not be included in the database. Construction companies are not included, so a lot of these companies are moving sand and gravel in very short distance local trips. Those won't be included. Transportation companies are not included, and that includes everything from your trucking firm to third-party logistics firms. None of these types of companies are included in the survey. A lot of that is to make sure there's not double counting between shippers and carriers in the survey, but it does have implications for what is and isn't included in the ultimate commodity flow survey database. And then also, retail and service industries are not included in the data as well. So again, a lot of these truck trips related to those sectors will be short distance truck trips, which will be important at the local level, but again, not included in commodity flow survey. The other thing to keep in mind is, as I mentioned, there's over 100 regions, there's seven modes, there's 23 commodities, so you end up, you know, trying to fill in a multi-dimensional matrix of over a million different cells. And ultimately, the 100,000 survey responses can't cover each of these cells, so you'll end up with several cells that either have small values or zero values, and are difficult to really estimate or for various reasons need to be suppressed in the commodity flow survey database. And then also, the commodity flow survey also has special consideration in terms of making sure that they suppress data that might give proprietary information about individual companies that might make that information public. So a lot of times this information will be, if a particular company dominates an industry in a region, then that information will not be, it'll be suppressed in the CFS database, and it won't be something that's available in the ultimate product.
We're doing that for talking ops.
And then in terms of the survey mechanism, I think it's important to understand how the commodity flow survey is actually done. Basically, the shippers are selected at random. Each shipper that they identify is requested to provide 40 shipments over a one-week period for 4 weeks in the year. And these 40 shipments are requested at regular intervals. So depending on the size of the company, it could be every 20th shipment, every 1,000th shipment, or if they have less than 40 shipments in a week, they'll just ask to be recording every shipment that the company produces. But the part of the complexity in terms of implementing the survey is what do you do with these multi-stop tours for trucks that make multiple stops as they conduct their deliveries or pickups across a local area. And the way it's done is it's actually not incorporated into the specific methodology, so that if you can imagine a truck making a multi-stop tour, and if the third stop is the one that the commodity flow survey is requesting information on, only information on that stop will be included, but no information on the previous stop or the one after it will be included. So it's going to look like a single shipment from the establishment to that third stop, and then back to the establishment is how it will basically be recorded in the CFS. So it's accurate in terms of commodity flow information, but once you try to translate that into truck trip information, you can see that you'll be missing a lot of information there. Just to summarize the issues related to the commodity flow survey, several sectors are not included, and many of these do have local truck trips, significant amounts of local truck trips that will be missing in the commodity flow survey. Trip tours or trip chaining is not incorporated. The other thing I should mention is that because retail establishments are not included, and because this is an address-based survey of U.S. establishments, import flows are not captured at their port of entry in the commodity flow survey database. So you can imagine a container coming in to L.A. Long Beach, and if the first destination is a retail establishment or some sort of logistics transportation company, then that flow is still not picked up until it actually hits one of the sectors that is measured in the commodity flow survey. And then there's a number of open questions that are related to commodity flow survey that where, it's hard to come up with an answer in terms of how it's impacting the survey, but just things to be aware of. First, you'll have companies that may cross multiple industries. I like to think of Hewlett Packard, which, on the one hand, they ship a lot of stuff, whether it's computers, printers, servers, etc. But they also have a large services component as well. So you can imagine their establishments across the country will have a mix of these types of activities occurring, and depending on which one gets the survey, it's going to have very different results in terms of the shipments that are shown, identified for that particular establishment. So that's a complexity that it's unclear how that plays out in terms of the data, so it's something to be aware of. The other thing to think about is that, again, at the local level, the smaller trucking firms, the ones that have less sophisticated tracking software in terms of their shipments, it's going to be harder for them to fill out the survey in any sort of accurate manner because they just don't track shipments in a manner in which they can be saying, in a manner in which they can be asking about, what does every 20th shipment look like, or what does every 5th shipment look like, just because they don't have a method of actually tracking this information. And what does that mean in terms of how they fill out the survey? It's a kind of an open question in terms of how that is going to play out. So moving on to the Freight Analysis Framework database, the key features of this database is that it's built entirely from public data sources. It does rely on the commodity flow survey as its base data, to estimate the value of the cells that are marked as zero in the quantity flow survey. And then in terms of that, the CFS sectors that were not included, that so-called out-of-scope sectors that were not included in the original survey, it uses a combination of local employment, population, and truck activity data to estimate the values of these shipments. In terms of the issues that arise from the CFS, just to summarize them, first is what's happening in terms of the zero cells is it's a good method, but it can be problematic in terms of the data that's suppressed for proprietary reasons, and that's because this data is going to be very different from the existing data, which is the reason why it was suppressed. So to use existing data to estimate it is going to be, again, problematic in terms of making sure of trying to feel like you have a comfort level in terms of the data that's estimated there. Additionally, there's no field data that was used to validate the methods that were used for these out-of-scope sectors. So even though, you know, local data were used, it was hard to tell if the relationships that were established in this process match with what's actually happening out in the field. And then even if they do on average match with what's happening in the field, it's going to be different for different localities. So you can imagine that, you know, farm shipments in Arkansas might have a different relationship between employment and output than they would for farm shipments in California or Florida or other locations. And again, that's something that's not really varied in the current FAT database. In terms of TransSearch, TransSearch is a privately maintained freight flow database. It is an easy source of county-level freight flow data. The key features of the methodology that make it different than the other two is that one, it relies on a much more heavily on kind of economic output data and employment data. The company that produces this database has access to a lot more of this information than what's available publicly, and they utilize this in the database. They also have a proprietary motor carrier data exchange, which is basically a database of origins and destinations and commodities for some of the major trucking firms in the country. And they use this to actually provide additional information in terms of how their truck trips are distributed across the country. But they still rely on CFS for these shorter distance truck trips because the ones that are in the data exchange tend to be the larger companies, tend to also oversample for longer truck trips as well. So the issues that you'll have with TransSearch are very similar to what you see at CFS at the local level. In terms of the NCFRP project that I mentioned before, NCFRP 20, developing subnational commodity flow databases, one of the things that we found in the literature review for the study is that there have been several attempts to disaggregate the FAT database, the FAT 2 database, down to a local level to do freight planning by state DOTs and NPOs. But there have been a lot fewer efforts to actually build up data from the bottom up based on either surveys or economic data to understand how truck flows are really occurring at the local level. And also importantly, there haven't been a lot of efforts that really validate the relationship between these socioeconomic data and freight flows as they occur, again, out in the field. And some of the early data that we're getting indicates that this method is probably more accurate for some commodities as opposed to others. And that's what we see on this slide. One of the examples of disaggregating FAT data actually looked at the FAT2 database and developed relationships between the commodities that were being estimated and different socioeconomic data at the FAT regional level. And you can see that in terms of the R-squared that was developed by regressing these variables, that the fit between socioeconomic data and the ultimate commodity that's being estimated it varied significantly by commodity. So you had the R-squared ranging from 11%, it went all the way up past 90% for some commodities, but we're just showing the lower R-squareds here. And basically what this says is that, yes, this methodology works for some commodities, but not others, in which case we'd have to come up with different methodologies to estimate some of these commodities that can't be estimated well using this socioeconomic data. In terms of the overall steps that we're going to be applying for NCFRP 20, one of the things that we're going to be doing is looking at a range of freight planning applications that are being attempted at the local level, identify supply supply chains that either have a high value in terms of dollar amounts, high volume in terms of tonnage, or just problematic in general, such as these import flows that I mentioned before. And then assessing the methods that we reviewed in the earlier task in terms of how well they can address these, kind of these generic supply chains that I mentioned before. And then we'll actually test out some of the methods by collecting small samples of data and then ultimately develop a guidebook that's going to first describe the different data sources, what their strengths and weaknesses are, and also talk pretty extensively about how we can supplement some of these national databases using local freight data collection efforts. And I did want to spend some time talking about a few freight data collection efforts that have been done at the local level in Washington. And as we go through, we can see the methodologies are pretty similar across different commodity types or across different processes for different commodities as you do these from the bottom up. The first example is a potato production example, and the second one is a diesel production example. Again, they're both from the state of Washington and done by the Washington DOT and the, one of the universities up in Washington as well. For the potato production example, what they basically did was they started by looking at the production data that was available from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This was provided by the Washington State Potato Commission, and that's one of the things to really note in this example, the potato production example, is that this Washington State Potato Commission actually had a lot of the data that they used as a single source, and they were able to really leverage this significantly so that they could make their estimation process much easier. But the first step is what's shown on this slide is where are the potatoes being produced in terms of the actual farm locations where they're being grown. The next step is to understand where are the processing facilities and where are they located and what percent of the potatoes that are grown are going to these facilities as opposed to going to end markets and being delivered fresh. And this was done, again, by using some of the experts that are associated with the Washington State Potato Commission, interviewing them and understanding where these facilities are located, how big are they, and what some of their input sources are in terms of where they're getting the potatoes from. And then ultimately they used a survey that the commission had done to understand how the origin and destinations played out between where the potatoes were grown, where the processing facilities are located, and what some of the destinations were for some of these goods as well. And then ultimately, after the flows were distributed, they were assigned to trucks. The freight flows were assigned to trucks and routed across the Washington State Highway Network to understand which of the corridors were actually most important in terms of moving these goods. So this can be contrasted with the diesel supply chain example, which did not have a single source of information the way the potato example did. Instead, what you have is information kind of bits and pieces spread across a lot of different agencies. The Washington Department of Agriculture regulates the quality and quantity of fuel delivered at gas stations, and that's both gas and diesel. The Washington Department of Ecology regulates underground diesel storage tanks, and also publishes vessel entry data for diesel and for other commodities. The U.S. EPA regulates above-ground storage tanks. The Department of Revenue in Washington is responsible for assessing and collecting fuel tax at terminal locations. And then you have other agencies which, are most specific in terms of their monitoring activity. You have agencies that monitor pipelines, waterborne activities, railroads, etc. And basically, it was a long process of cobbling together data from all these different sources that led to a combination of estimating and actual data to get to the final result, which was understanding the flows for diesel supply chains. And you can see, again, just looking at this map, the complexity that was involved, because you have the orange dots, which are the terminals, the arrows, which represent flows across different modes. And basically, the process is assigning a number to each of those arrows. And, using all the disparate data sources, it became much more complex than the potato example in terms of getting to the ultimate flows for each of the different commodities in particular. In terms of the conclusions, in terms of probably going to require a mix of actual data that can come either from receipts or economic output data, and also some estimated data. And a good example is that you can generally find production data relatively easily, but in terms of understanding distribution data, in terms specifically origin destinations, that's going to be something that's much more difficult to find. And typically, again, when you have trade associations and industry experts, you can get, if not actual data from these sources, you can at least get people to sanity check some of your methodologies that are used in terms of estimating these things at a local level. And then also, again, because there's different levels of complexity for different commodities, you're probably not going to want to develop a bottom-up commodity flow database where you're trying to get this information for all commodities in your region. You're probably only going to want to do this for select commodities that are of interest either because they're, again, high-volume commodities or very critical to local economy, or things that have particularly complex supply chains that that you want to make sure you have a good understanding of. And it's important, though, I think, to understand that you have options when you see that some of these national freight data sources are not matching with what you expect at the local level. It's important to understand you have options in terms of how you, other ways in which you might be able to use local data to understand what the commodity flows are for specific commodities. And that is the conclusion of my presentation.
Okay, well, thank you, DK. I know we have a few questions typed in. We'll get to those at the end. I'm now going to turn it over to Mike Anderson of the University of Alabama, Huntsville. And Mike, let me get you back to the beginning of your presentation. Okay, and you can go ahead when you're ready.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, good morning. My presentation is going to talk about using some of this federal data that DK just talked about and combining it with some local information to actually do some case study modeling that we did freight in Alabama. Since we're starting off, the goal of all this was the process of developing freight origin destination matrices. And these matrices, or these OD matrices, the intention is to embed them into typical statewide or MPO travel demand models. And typically, in most locations, they're not dealing with freight in the travel demand model. It's basically a passenger car driven situation. And or if they're trying to do freight, it's sort of implicitly brought in, but we're looking to explicitly model freight. And essentially what we're trying to come up with is, at the top level, if you have these national freight data sources that we've just been talking about, the FAF2 commodity flow survey trans-search data, they basically take a big picture view of freight. On the lower end, you come down here and you have local surveys, such that I can go out in an MPO or within a state, and I can ask questions and collect freight data from a couple main shippers in my community. But the reality is, most of us fall somewhere in the middle here, where we're looking for, you know, to drive the top down, as we say, you know, basically to disaggregate the national level freight data down to something useful, while at the same time using local survey information to give us knowledge to help build up and meet somewhere in the middle and use it for freight projects. The way this is set up, we designed this integrated freight planning framework, and it starts over here on the side. You basically have the FAF2 data, which is the source we use, and then some local industry survey information. And we did a disaggregation of the FAF2, and we aggregated the industry survey information into current and future years, developed the information based on what we're calling freight analysis zones. And this is somewhere in between the federal region and down to what you get at the traffic analysis zones inside an MPO. So there's some level where freight is appropriate. And then the process goes through distributing the freight trips, assigning them to the network, doing some analysis, and then finally looking at your system output or system performance measures to see what freight's really doing in your community. First, I'm going to talk about statewide application. We're looking at Alabama and the statewide model. I'll step back a little bit to talk about the freight analysis framework. It's version 2, or actually it's version 2.2, I believe. It had 114 zones, 17 ports of entry, 43 commodities, 7 have 8 counties around Birmingham, and we have the rest of the state of Alabama. Now, if you're trying to do statewide freight modeling with just 2 zones, you essentially get trips that go from the Birmingham area into the rest of Alabama. You get one road connecting between them, and that's all your freight travel. And it's not really good enough. And, you know, what we're trying to get is freight trips between counties on major state and U.S. highways. So what we need to do is come up with some methodology to disaggregate 2 zones into a larger number of zones. And basically, the logical decision was to try to go to the county level. We could go from 2 zones to 67 counties. And what we found in doing our analysis is that using personal income of the county and the value of shipment for the county gave us the best 2 measures to perform the disaggregation based on. And essentially, what the personal income allowed us to do, it allowed us to incorporate a population / income factor that really represented buying power, because, you know, we have counties in Alabama that may have a lot of people, but not a lot of income. There's not a lot being brought in. Other counties have less people, but a lot more discretionary income. There's a lot more delivery, a lot more freight activity associated, especially in the mixed goods type commodity. Then on the production side, we brought in value of shipment that really looked at the value of what was being shipped, because we have a lot of situations in Alabama where industries are transferring from labor, direct labor, into basically automizing their facilities. And what that allowed is they could actually ship more value by hiring less people. So using these factors, we were able to do some of this disaggregation. But going back, again, we wanted to look at modeling freight within the state. So the first step was to look at pass-through freight. And essentially, as a modeler, we could pull the 114 zones together and basically just do an assignment of everything that was flowing through. So this map gives us kind of the blue is showing basically by thickness of the lines all the freight that's passing through the state of Alabama and roughly where it's coming from and going to. So we can start to see some of the freight flow patterns associated with Alabama, at least from an internal, external, external, internal, and a pass-through format. To validate this, we looked at truck crossings at the state line to how many trucks per day the state was counting crossing between Alabama and our neighboring states, the tons of freight per year modeled from the FAF2 in that map I just showed before, and looked at how many pounds per truck and looked for legitimacy in that to give us a good idea that we were getting at least a good information about pass-through and trips that had either a start or an end outside the state of Alabama. And we started saying, okay, well, now we can go in and we can start modeling inside the state of Alabama. Should be simple. Break it down into the county, everything will be in good shape. What we found was there was actually a lot going on with freight. We went from 2 zones, and, well, initially we said, well, there's a zone around Birmingham. We have a variety of freight moving just in Birmingham, or the 8-county Birmingham area. There's a lot of freight moving in the rest of Alabama. We had freight from FAF2 going from Zone 1 to Zone 2, Zone 2 to Zone 1, outside to the rest of the country, inside to the rest of the country. Started looking at this, came up with 9 specific trip purposes associated in a statewide model for modeling freight from strictly the FAF2 standpoint. Now, building in some local survey information, when we started getting into the county, this is where we come up here and we start looking at trying to do some sort of equation that disaggregates everything. And what we have in here is we go into each county and pull out, for example, population, personal income, employment, and value of shipment for the county, and use the county-level value in some combination with a certain weighting factor criteria to get to disaggregate the freight down to the appropriate level. And as I said before, the key elements were really weighted on this personal income variable and the value of shipment variable for this particular county gave us the best results. And we set up experiments and we varied the weighting factors tremendously and did a design of experiments to come up with the optimal solution. And you know, you can see on the graph we got reasonably good projections of freight traffic that compared to freight traffic that was counted by the Alabama Department of Transportation for us. Moving this forward, we said we could break it down and we could model the state using counties essentially as our freight zones. Well, what we wanted to do after that was to see if we could go into an urbanized area, which would essentially be a sub-county area. So we entered a project and we were working with Mobile, Alabama on the Gulf Coast, and what we were trying to do was come up with some freight and see if we could build freight into their urban model. And one of the reasons we chose Mobile is there's a lot going on in Mobile. It's the crossroads between Interstate 10 running east-west across the bottom part of the country, and Interstate 65, which runs north-south. So there's a lot of freight going on. There's a tunnel that runs under a portion of Mobile Bay, which is highly congested with freight activity. There's a variety of railroads, waterway, steamship company, trade zones, trucking companies, a lot of freight activity happening in Mobile. And before we started this, there was actually no freight modeling being done. Essentially, the Alabama DOT was collecting the traffic count and essentially coming up with some sort of roughly estimated percent truck trips on all the roads. And in the modeling process, these truck trips were based on percentages estimated as a portion of non-home-based trips. And looking at the numbers, there was just no way to get the numbers in Mobile high enough on certain roads that were dominated by truck traffic using this methodology. Then you add to the fact that trucks are not explicitly modeled in either internal, external, or pass-through trips. Basically, they were modeling cars only, and what they found was their community that has a variety of alternate modes of transportation besides just passenger cars, and it's mainly trucks running around the community. So what we wanted to do is wanted to drive down and get sub-county. But when we wanted to go sub-county, it really became a question of what do we need to collect from the local industry to really kind of disaggregate this below the county level. When we disaggregated for the state, we used the county compared to other counties. For example, the value of sales, the value of shipment in one county, could be directly compared with another county, and we could see which county would be dominant. When we started getting below or sub-county, then we really needed to shift and start focusing on what do the specific industries in the county have to or provide, or what can they give us? How can we work with them? How can we build relationships with them so we can use their information for planning purposes? So what we developed was essentially a two-page data collection tool, and members or staff from the Mobile MPO would go out and ask key questions to try to develop information that we were looking for. Essentially, we wanted the business description. We wanted the number of shipments either made or received over the course of a week or a month. We wanted to know the compass direction for those shipments. And this was important because we didn't want to ask them who the freight was either being brought in or shipped to. We don't really care in that aspect. All we want to know is what direction is it going, east, north, or west. Now, essentially, south means you're going out in the Gulf of Mexico at Mobile, but which compass direction? Because if I know essentially where your business is located inside the MPO, and you tell me I have 7 trucks a week that I load up and I send east of here.
Yeah, Sean said they forgot to make
from that information, we can pretty much figure out how much freight you're moving based on what you do and the direction it's going. That'll tell us how many trucks you're putting on the road and where they're heading and how they're getting out of town. Because generally, these freight trips, there's a direction they're going out of town, and most of the time in an urbanized area, you know the main routes out of town. So we were looking for compass direction, number of shipments. We wanted to work in the weight of the shipment so we could start looking at what was being shipped, how much it weighed to start developing a database for converting tons to vehicles, the value of the goods, and finally we asked the shippers any transportation problems at their location. And what this question did is it actually gave the shippers an input into the MPO process. Now a lot of this prior to going out and doing the survey, was talking to them and convincing them that what we were doing is trying to collect information that would actually make them, or make them, so they can do their job easier. We want to help them and be sure that they can get product into and out of the community in a timely fashion. And if they don't have a chance to tell us what the problems are, then you know, they're not going to be as likely to tell us what's going on out there.
And Barbara left.
I knew that.
And so essentially we gathered the information, started looking at where it was going. Again, it's proprietary, so we didn't need to know their customer. We just needed to know how much, what it was worth, how much it weighed, and what direction was it roughly heading. That was good enough. And we went through the process, and as I say, we worked with someone at the MPO who actually conducted the majority of the surveys. And they went through, and we collected several hundred survey results and could build up a database of information to say, here's the direction, here's the quantity, here's what freight is doing inside the MPO. So we had a basis to then try to disaggregate from the county to sub-county areas. Again, when we sat sub-county, we started working with the MPO model. We still had a variety of trip purposes associated with things going on, the external, external. Essentially anything that was shipped from Florida to Texas, at some point on I-10, it's passing through Mobile. You just have to work with it. We had stuff that came into the nation from Alabama. If it was coming from the New Orleans area and it was going to Birmingham, for example, it probably came at some point through Mobile. It's just the way into Alabama. Started looking at the port. The port had its own issues. The port out to the nation, the port to Alabama, the port into Mobile County. You know, all this location information comes with a variety of trip purposes and how to work with this stuff. Finally, we got to the Mobile assignment. What we actually did is we put together, from all those trip purposes, a single origin destination freight-only file. And since we say freight, we're talking truck, but a truck origin destination file that could be modeled in the network. And the way it was actually modeled in the network was it was assigned as a preload to the transportation network, such that the freight trips were assigned onto an empty network, such that freight trips, for example, an external freight movement, would not get bumped onto a side road, as could potentially happen if you were loading freight with the passenger cars, and they were doing an assignment technique that actually moved traffic to alternate paths. In this situation, the freight had first crack, it got on the network, and this ability to preload gave us the good freight modeling information that Mobile could use for assignment purposes. Essentially, the overall conclusion, they had the ability to model truck trips in either and we say regional, we didn't do regional, I just talked about statewide and local, but it gives the ability to do statewide, local, you could do regional kind of truck trips. It's using the FAS2 forecast. But combining that local information, I think that's the important thing to take out of this, is that yes, the FAF2 does provide a large amount of information, but unless you go in and get that local freight data, either at the county level to understand differences between county and a statewide level, or if you start going sub-county and start talking to individual shippers, you know, it really is hard to disaggregate that FAF2 data without that local information. And it gives the ability to analyze projects and consider the freight impact to projects in such a way that we haven't been doing before. And that's the end of what I have to say.
Well, thank you, Mike. We'll now move on to our final presentation given by Joel Falter of KOA Corporation. And Joel, I will bring up your presentation. And again, let me get yours back to the beginning. Sorry about that. And you can begin.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon. Good morning, everybody. What I'm going to talk about today is our experience in conducting OD truck surveys and studies in Southern California. The focus of my presentation is really going to be on the trials and tribulations, if you will, of getting hard, good movement data. And specifically, I want to talk to you about how the data has been collected, what it's being used for, the challenges and lessons learned in collecting the kind of data that that many of you are interested in, the kind of data that goes into the previous presentations you saw, and then very briefly some of the findings, because we have so much information I couldn't really cover all of it in one presentation. So let me start off with just some background on what we've done. So far to date, we've collected and performed OD surveys on three corridors in Southern California, Highway 395, US 6 and 14 for Caltrans, the California Department of Transportation. State Route 58, which was a combined effort between the San Bernardino Association of Governments, KernCog, and Caltrans, and then an I-5 SR-99 corridor study for KernCog. Currently underway, now we've recently been commissioned to conduct a rural roads OD goods movement study, which will kind of be the final piece in the puzzle for Kern County in how goods and commodities flow throughout Kern County and the San Joaquin Valley and other areas. To date, we've successfully surveyed 19,770 truck drivers as part of these three efforts, and been able to interview and talk to over 500 different firms dealing with logistics or trucking or general goods movement. Now, we've collected and processed this enormous amount of data for what's actually a relatively modest cost, if you will. You know, data is always expensive to get. It's always hard to get. For example, Kern Council of Government, which is a medium-sized MPO, if you will, they funded three of the studies, as you can see, in partnership with Sandag for the State Route 58 study. They commissioned the I-5 and SR-99 studies and the rural road studies. The Highway 395 corridor study was conducted by Caltrans. You know, the KernCog effort, for example, cost about $250,000, and all four studies combined will have cost just around $500,000. So it is possible to get a lot of data for a relatively inexpensive outlay of money if you plan correctly. For your reference, I want to show you the study areas so you have an idea of where we conducted these. This is the 395 corridor. It's the eastern side of the state of California, running along the eastern Sierra. So our study area went from the north near the state line down towards the Mojave area.
So they get a different route.
Right.
The State Route 58 study, which is an east-west major highway that links Northern California and points north, Oregon, Washington, with points in the eastern United States. So we covered areas from on the west, from the Bakersfield area, all the way into San Bernardino County, into the Barstow area. So quite an extensive area was covered in that project. The I-5 SR-99 corridor covers on the north end from roughly from Tulare County through the heart of Kern County all the way down towards the county line with Los Angeles in the Lubbock area. So it's quite an extensive area, and these are major freeway and highway corridors, which did present a lot of challenges, as I will go through with you. And then finally, this is the rural routes study that we're presently studying in Kern County. And the rural routes represent, if you will, the missing link, because these are all the state highways that provide the local access to regional and interstate goods movement between areas outside to local producers, shippers, manufacturers, and so on. So it's an important piece of their puzzle. So you might ask, well, why are they doing this work, and what's the interest? And as you know, goods movement is a hot topic and something that's very important to everyone. And each agency that we've worked with so far had some unique interests and things they wanted to accomplish, as well as some similar needs. But the basic premise was to get a better understanding of goods movement and what its impacts and effects are on the local community and the elected officials and planning professionals and everyone recognized that truck traffic was growing, and it seemed to be growing year after year, not only on the interstate and state highways, but on local roads. And while they recognized it was growing, they didn't really have a good understanding of how to explain it or what it meant to them or how it would affect planning decisions in the future. So combined, all these studies set out to get a good understanding of what type of truck traffic is out there, what are the goods being moved on our highways, where are these goods going, how many shipments occur at different times of the year, are there seasonal variations, when are they traveling, what are their needs, what's happening on an interstate and intrastate level, and what are other people doing around the country. So we've also conducted literature reviews to find out how are other people dealing with goods movement, how are they studying the impacts of goods on their local roads and highways, and what does it mean from a planning perspective. So with all this data in hand, it now gives all of these agencies a lot of different tools and a lot of different resources to do a lot of different things. So for example, in Caltrans' case, it allowed them to have a better understanding of when trucks travel and how trucks travel to help them plan in long-range infrastructure operations and safety planning. And safety planning was a key interest to Caltrans and many of the other agencies, because as you saw from the figures, the eastern side of the state and parts of Kern County and the San Juan Joaquin Valley, for example, are rural in nature. And when you see the volume of hazardous materials and hazardous goods that move on our highways, it allows them to start to plan for emergencies, for example. Many fire departments, local agencies may not have the resources in hand to handle a big emergency, so it gives them some better understanding of what's traveling through the area. Kern-COG and Sandag and SCAG and many of the agencies, just like the rest of you around the country, are very interested in goods movement from a long range and a forecasting perspective. So we're providing data to assist in the forecasting process. We had a previous presentations on modeling, and much of the information we've collected is going into the modeling process that these agencies are developing. In addition to the state and regional level, the data is what we've collected also allows local agencies to tap into what's coming down the road. How do we start to plan for trucks as they get off the freeway and get off the highway? We think of truck travel as interstate or interregional, but there are a lot of localized impacts that have to be taken into consideration when we start to see warehouse facilities and distribution facilities popping up, and how do we plan for those trucks, and how do we make sure we have the right infrastructure in place to handle those types of movements. Air quality, of course, is an important issue here in Southern California. We're under direction by the state to address greenhouse gas emissions and other air quality issues. So a lot of this data in terms of volume and fleet and age of trucks is important to have, and we now have a resource that can be shared throughout the state and, of course, throughout the region. So I can't overstate, moving on, to how much goes into getting this kind of data. It is a very, very labor-intensive effort. It's a very detailed process. It involves collecting automatic vehicle classification counts on the roads, round the clock, picture manual classification counts at key locations, interchanges, and roadway and highway junctions, 24-hour round-the-clock truck driver intercept surveys, commercial fleet operator surveys, which we did with one of our study partners, the Tioga Group, where we've also talked to the fleet operators and the trucking companies and the logistics companies to get an understanding of their operations and supplement what we didn't get from the truck drivers. Counts and surveys were conducted for different seasons, the throughout the year to see if there are variations between spring and fall into what goods move when or how goods move, or just get a better understanding of what's going on. And a new challenge in the data collection effort right now is on the rural roads project, where we're going to employ video technology because of some physical right-of-way limitations, which I will be getting into in my presentation. So a lot of different things have gone into collecting the data I'm going to be talking about. So the biggest challenges you'll face when undertaking this kind of effort is you have to keep in mind, unlike a trip generation type study or a parking study, is we're not collecting this kind of data at the mall. You're literally collecting data from a moving target. So you have to keep in mind, when doing studies like this, the physical environment. You know, where am I going to conduct this study? You know, we did these projects on interstate highways and major state highways, so these are high-volume, high-speed facilities, so we need to find a place that's safe to conduct these kinds of studies. You need to find places where you will minimize interruption to traffic flow, to traffic operations, maintaining driver safety at all times, minimizing the disruption to interstate commerce, having the right people to do the job. Having the right people is critical in terms of data collection and data interpretation. Getting meaningful data, it's great to say, well, we want to get truck flow information and find out what trucks are carrying and where they're going and so on, but you have to know what questions to ask and ask the right questions, and we spent a lot of time doing that. And then finally, you have to figure out, well, how do I get the information I want if I can't actually pull trucks over someplace to collect this kind of data? So with these challenges come lessons learned. And in fact, I'll have to tell you, with all the lessons we've learned, we're still facing new challenges and we're still learning new things. So even though we're on our fourth round of doing this, there's always new things and new challenges to learn and things to figure out and have a new game plan. So let me take a few minutes here and go through what we've learned to date so I can help any of you that are thinking about embarking on a detailed OD goods movement study make it a success. So, like, first thing, of course, is the best laid planning efforts always have speed bumps, and the project of this magnitude requires over-planning, over-communicating. It's a continuous communication and coordination process from the time you get started to getting people involved to actually pulling off the surveys to keeping them going. You constantly have to plan and replan and talk to all the partners that are involved in this, and I'll talk in a few minutes about who those partners are, so you can make sure it's a success. You have to provide adequate resources to ensure the success of the study. You need to have resources in terms of manpower. You need to have resources in terms of equipment. When you're doing these things round the clock, there are just a lot of things you need to have out there. So while these have been cost-effective projects done to date, we had a lot of discussion and dialogue with our clients to discuss what the needs were going to be and what it was really going to cost and what they were going to get for that cost, to ensure they got what they wanted and we delivered what they asked for. So here are some of the details of what we learned. In terms of coordination and communication in conducting these types of projects, obviously you need to start as early as possible. And I would say by as early as possible, if you were planning on conducting a survey, you know, in the fall or in the spring, you want to be 4 to 6 months ahead of time in laying the groundwork for getting your survey done. That means bringing all the players together that are going to be involved. So it's not only their state DOT folks they need to think about, but there's law enforcement, other lead agency, all your team members. If you're using temporary help, if you're using survey crews, other equipment, traffic handling providers, whoever you're working with, you need to get everybody together so they understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, when you're going to do it, and what everybody needs and expects, because as you go through this process, you find new needs and new challenges and new requirements will come up. And even though you can be doing a project like this for one agency, many agencies have, Caltrans for example, has many different divisions. So you have planning divisions, and you have safety divisions, and you have construction divisions, and highway operations divisions. And it's important that all of those people, if you're a state DOT, are on the same page and are part of the process so everyone's needs can be addressed. So when you get out there and get these surveys going, you don't run into any pitfalls or have things go wrong. You have to have contingency plans for when things do go wrong, because things do go wrong. So you need, for example, to make sure the survey site's going to be available for the days you conduct the survey and in working order. We had experience where one of our survey sites was going to be closed for emergency repairs, and that wasn't known until very shortly before we were going to begin the survey. But we had instances where a piece of equipment malfunctioned, a changeable message sign, and that had to be repaired in order to allow the survey to be conducted at a weigh station that the Highway Patrol was manning. Without that changeable message sign that would be able to help control the flow of traffic, we were not going to be able to proceed. So when you're going to be working, it's important that you understand that everything's going to be working. Visit your sites far in advance, get as-built plans, get aerial photos, get a good understanding of the physical environment so you can understand, how am I going to pull this off? How am I going to collect the surveys? Where are the trucks going to stop? Where are my staff going to be positioned? How am I going to deal with this much traffic? Because, as you'll see, conducting OD studies of trucks on interstate and state highways with high volume builds up a lot of truck traffic very quickly. So you need to have all of this in place before you get started. So you really need to think ahead. And it's, again, a continuing and ongoing process as you do it. Staffing is very important, as you expect. Whenever there's an interactive human process and people have to deal with each other, that creates challenges. So challenges from the staffing perspective will make or break your project. And when I say hire the right people, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's very true. You know, we learned this in some respects the hard way as we started, but got better at it over time. Is you have to hire the right people, and you really need to specify if you're going to use temporary labor to staff your surveys, that you get the right people and that they have the right skills and that they have the ability to write and talk well, that they can understand what's being told to them, that they can articulate questions clearly to two drivers. You're out in an open environment, people are in a rush, people are in a bad mood, so you need to have people with a good temperament and that are going to be able to stay with you over the long haul and deliver what you need. Bilingual skills, of course, is a plus. We've become more of a bilingual nation. Not all truck drivers speak just English. Many drivers speak other languages. Spanish was a prevalent language among many of our drivers, so it would be useful, depending on your area, to have people that can speak a second language such as Spanish, just to be able to enhance the effectiveness of the survey, of the surveyors, and the success of the survey. When using temporary labor, you know, make sure you screen the surveyors personally. We had, in our experience, temporary staff where there were personnel difficulties and challenges, and people that were less enthusiastic in some cases than others, or had other issues, and they weren't the right kind of people for the job. So when you call an agency and say, I want to hire 50 people to conduct a survey, make sure you meet with those people and they understand they're going to be outside, maybe through the middle of the night, for example, and they have the temperament to do that. You want to conduct training with everyone in advance so they understand how it's going to work, so you see how they're going to perform and act in doing this, and make sure they have the right stuff, if you will, to do this kind of work, and make sure you're going to have the right people and the same people with you throughout the conduct of your survey. You don't want to have crews that are, well, I'm here for the morning part, but I'm going home, but we're going to send someone else. You want continuity, so if you're going to be out there for 48 hours, as we were in some cases, you want to have the same people that are rotating in and out to make sure this is a success, and you don't want to have any surprises or have new people get involved that don't understand what's going on. And then finally, you want to plan your staffing levels carefully, because you, of course, need to be mindful of rest periods, the labor requirements of your state. But we had a case where one of our survey sites was fairly remote in terms of its physical location to lodging. So while we had the right coverage for our survey crews, we hadn't thought about the drive time for people to go from the survey site back to their motels and to come back. So that really impacted their rest period and affected their comfort. So having more people than you need is also a plus, so you make sure your crews rotate and are fully rested. So once you're ready to go, you've done all this planning, you've got the site, you've got the people, everything's on tap, and you're going to start your surveys tomorrow. Check back in with law enforcement and your local DOT or who's ever in charge of enforcing operations in your area, because you might meet with the local commander of a highway patrol office or a field operations manager from your state highway department. But these organizations run around the clock and have people on different shifts, and the people that you met with in the middle of the day may not be the people working in the middle of the night. So you want to make sure that everyone knows and that they've communicated and the memo's gone out. The bulletin board says, by the way, the survey is being conducted today for 24 hours, and there'll be these people out there. So someone coming upon a survey crew that didn't get the memo doesn't decide they're going to shut the survey down or are not going to wake you up at 3 in the morning to ask who you are and why are you out on the highway. So checking with law enforcement the day of, the day before, throughout, to make sure there's no problems is very important. Make sure your survey sites, as I said, are in working order. Important is to quality control the survey process as you're going. Take a look at what people are writing down, listen to what they're saying, make sure they're on message, on script, getting you the information that you asked for. Have good supervisors out there that can deal with problem surveyors or problems as they come up, because we are dealing with people, and when they're out there and they're cold or they're hot, it's windy and they're tired, you need someone to keep them on track and keep them focused and deal with problems as they come up, whether it's from truck drivers or whether questions come up from law enforcement or transportation officials. You need to be respectful of everyone's time when you're, of course, out on the road and truck drivers have given you the courtesy to pull over, be brief, get to the point, ask the questions, let them get on their way. When you're conducting phone interviews, you want to ask relevant and reasonable questions, things people can answer, not send them off on a research project and take up a lot of their time. These are all busy people, and we're asking them to do us a favor and help us in the planning process by giving us information and data, so we want to be as mindful of their time as we possibly can. It's important to also let people know what you're doing, why you're doing it, so they feel like they're part of the process. They're not just answering questions, you're not just wasting their time. Let them know that this is part of a bigger planning process and their opinion counts. Very often people are angry and they vent, you know, why did you stop me, why did I have to stop? They're angry. They want to yell at you and complain about the national debt and everything else that's wrong with society. Let them vent, because then once they've gotten that off their chest, they're often very encouraged to help and answer your questions. And the final lesson we learned in survey operations are, in fact, the lollipops don't work. Trip drivers probably don't like lollipops. We thought we would give them a treat for stopping. But they not only don't like lollipops, but they have a lot of suggestions on what you should do with lollipops. So I would suggest you save the resources and don't buy lollipops. So our last lesson learned comes really at the end of the survey process. We've successfully done all of this data collection, and we've collected thousands of surveys. And then you have to plan on, once I've collected it, how am I going to interpret it? And when you come back to the office and you have cases and cases and cases and of surveys, it's time to input that data so someone can make use of it. So thinking ahead and how you're going to use the data and how you're going to input that information is important. Want to ID all the data by location so it's easy to catalog it. Make sure the surveyors have completed the entire survey. When you're doing the data collection effort, you want to make sure the surveys are fully filled out so when you get back you don't have some surprises. Code and simplify the surveys is very important. Different people hear the same thing differently, or people hear the same thing that's told to them differently, so, and how they interpret that and write it down is not always the same. So the less interpretation surveyors have to do, the better off you'll be. So if you can pre-plan the types of things you're looking for in answering your questions and have checkboxes and coded survey forms, it will make not only the survey process easier, but the data collection and data entry effort easier and more effective. And as you're entering data, you want to quality control that process to avoid mistakes and bad data entry or misinterpretation of answers, so people don't decide to catalog or summarize data incorrectly. So it's very important that you QC this process throughout. And in fact, QCing the process and communication is something that needs to be done over and over, from the planning process all the way through to the data interpretation and analysis process. So in this little bit of time I have left, what did we learn from all of this? Well, with all the data we've collected, we have a whole lot of goods movement data with endless, and I mean endless, analytical possibilities. And I don't have time in my presentation to go into everything that we've learned or what all the agencies are doing with the information, but they can share that with you, and I'll talk about that at the end. What I thought I would do is just take the last few minutes and show you what we did on the I-5 SR-99 study and go through how we summarize some of that data and discuss a little bit about some of the things we've learned, which in Kern County's cases, we learned that the county, and I think Kern Cog also would agree, that they learned that they've really become the crossroads of commerce. There's a lot of goods that move in and out and through the area. There are a number of logistics centers that have popped up in Kern County, like IKEA, Famous Footwear, Sears, Target, and a number of others. There's a lot of agricultural industry in the county, not only produce grown in the county in the San Joaquin Valley, but a lot of it produced into food and kindred products in the county. So a lot of different things go on in the county, and that gave them a good handle on goods movement and what's going on and how they can begin planning in the future to deal with this as their county grows.
Are they?
The truck intercept surveys on these two routes were conducted in six locations, as it shows here. They were conducted for 24 hours. We conducted them in two seasons, in the fall and in the spring, to get an understanding of if there were any differences in terms of commodities and the types of commodities that were being shipped throughout the year. These two studies, we collected over 7,000 surveys, and our calculation is we were surveying drivers at about a survey a minute. This shows the study area for these two corridors. We relied on a combination of rest areas and a rest area and a weigh station. So our involvement included the California Department of Transportation, or Caltrans, and the California Highway Patrol. They were integral part of the success of these projects and very important to helping us pull these off. So these gives you an idea of where we conducted these studies. I'm going to run through some of the results and the kinds of things we've displayed. We were able to produce a lot of data on the types of commodities that are most common in this corridor, and the most common commodities are shown here, which are agricultural products, farm products, transportation equipment, miscellaneous goods, and empty container shipments. So this represents the highest amount of commodities traveling through the study area. We've broken down, for their benefit, distribution information in terms of where these trucks they pass through are going to, where they're coming from. The information is available not only county by county in the state, city by city in the state, but also state by state in the country. So we have an understanding, they have an understanding of where all these trucks are going to and coming from. We've been able to break down and provide background data for their planning and other modeling and air quality purposes, what routes these drivers are taking, so we not only know where they're going point to point, but what combination of routes are that they are taking. So these are some examples from this survey for northbound and southbound flows and actual traffic assignments. So these are the actual routes drivers are taking. The information has also been broken down by product and is available in the database for every type of product that we surveyed. So this gives the same information in terms of where food and kindred products are going, empties, farm products, so it gives them the understanding of what type of commodities are traveling, where they're traveling, when they're traveling, how they're traveling. So there's just endless possibilities of data that they have, and there's just dozens and dozens more graphics and tables that are available, as well as the raw data to help in that planning process. We also conducted, as I said, fleet operator surveys, and we were able to get a good understanding of who uses these routes, when they use them, the kinds of things that they're traveling, where they go, and so on, how local users use these corridors and facilities. They have different needs than the interstate operators, so just a good understanding, a lot of data at the local level that they weren't aware of in terms of seasonal and local shipments. A lot of feedback from drivers, which we've passed along, and concerns on drivers in terms of safety and better road maintenance. And of course, they'd always like the speed limit to be higher, and where we should have bypass lanes or additional lanes added to make their jobs easier. So just a wealth of data and input from drivers and fleet operators on the most common needs that they have. So that, in summary, I know it was a lot, is my presentation. You see a link to KernCog's website. They have been gracious enough to post all three so far of the projects that have been completed to date. So they are PDFs and are downloadable from their website. And certainly the data is available, and we're available to answer questions of others if they wish to conduct these studies on their own. So that concludes my presentation, and thank you for your time.